Okay, welcome to this event this evening, in which we're going to be discussing Brexit and what Brexit means to you, what Brexit means to us. My name's Kevin Featherstone, and I'm a professor in the European Institute here at the school, and with a colleague, Tony Travers, who I'm going to introduce in a moment, we coordinate an LSE programme on Brexit. This involves a number of public events, lectures, debates, panel discussions. In fact, this Wednesday evening, there is a panel discussion, which is to take stock of where we are with Brexit in terms of the agreements that have been signed. And that's 6:30 this Wednesday. Tonight's event is in collaboration with the school library, and of course the library has its exhibition of What Does Brexit Mean to You? And you might have seen the exhibition as you entered the library. There is an electronic screen which is showing various comments that people have made about Brexit. And then if you enter one of the exhibition spaces, there's lots of post-it notes which have been put up there about comments that people have made about Brexit, what Brexit means to them in three words. Some of the comments, I think, are really quite ingenious, quite entertaining. I understand some of the comments have possibly been censored, that people were making comments which were rather too strong, too strongly worded. Although I think in fairness, if we think of the recent book by the journalist Robert Peston, the title of his book begins with the letters WTF. So I think many can have strong descriptions of what Brexit might mean to them. So the idea is that we're going to have a discussion. We shouldn't misinterpret the dynamics here. That I know we're sat at the top table, but we'd really like contributions from you, comments from you, in terms of what you think about Brexit and where you think it's going. But to get us started, then we've got a number of kickstart contributions from colleagues. Just to open us up, I'm going to ask each of them to tell us what they think of Brexit in three words, but then to give us a maximum of 10 minutes, colleagues, to speak, if you may. And we're delighted we have such a panel. We have Robert Saunders, who is a senior lecturer in modern British history at Queen Mary University here in London. Piers Ludlow is professor of international history and deputy head of the Department of International History here at the LSE. Jennifer Jackson-Priest is Associate Professor of Nationalism at the European Institute, formerly Deputy Head of the European Institute. Professor Tony Travers is Professor in the School of Public Policy in the Department of Government, and as I say, we are coordinators of the LSE programme on Brexit. We have a Twitter account. Of course, we have a Twitter hashtag. It is hashtag LSE Brexit. So as we go along, you could comment on hashtag LSE Brexit. So we're going to try to cover many different aspects of what Brexit means to us. And as I say, we're very much looking forward to your contributions. Amongst the speakers, we're going to be covering history, geography, demographics, parliamentary politics, etc. So we have a broad canvas here. And to get us started, I'm delighted that Robert Saunders has agreed to join us.
Thank you. Well, I'll come to my three words in a minute, but we were given three words that we were asked to talk about, which was past, present, and future. Now, I'm a historian, which means I only really do the past. But I think if history has anything to contribute to the Brexit debate, it is about trying to link Brexit to some of its longer-term roots, to think about where this relates to deindustrialization or the legacies of empire or the memory of the Second World War, or the history of the British state, and so on. But I do think that anything that historians say about Brexit in the past has to come with enormous flashing lights over it. And I think that's even more true when we talk about the present and the future. And to illustrate that, I published a book earlier this year, a bit of shameless advertising, which was on the first time that Britain had a referendum on Europe in 1975. And towards the end, I talk about some of the predictions that were made after the result. So it was widely predicted that the old established parties were on the way out. It was predicted that a new age of consensus politics was about to dawn, that Ted Heath was back as a major political figure, Tony Benn was finished, and so on. So every single prediction that was made after that referendum was wrong. Now, that was a referendum that endorsed the status quo, that voted to carry on doing what we were already doing. Whereas what we've been living through since 2016 is like a tsunami. And if we're honest, it's a tsunami that most of us in academia didn't see coming. And I certainly feel like, really ever since 2016, I've been stumbling in the dark, trying to understand what's going on, and largely operating in a world that I feel I don't really understand anymore. So it's important, I think, that we try to understand Brexit and we try to explain Brexit. But I also think that we have to be quite modest about our ability to predict the future or even to analyse the present. And I think intellectually we've all got our L plates on in relation to Brexit. And it doesn't always feel like that when I read some of the commentary. So my first key words would actually be humility, the sense that all of us are pupils in this. My second key word would be party, and it's about why referendums happen in the first place. Direct democracy is obviously comparatively rare in Britain. We don't have referendums very often. And yet we have already had two referendums on Europe, and we might be heading to a third. And I think what that reminds us is that the party system in Britain has never been able to contain the forces that the European debate unleashes. We've never been able to hold this issue inside the established party boundaries. To illustrate that, before the first referendum in 1975, Harold Wilson was absolutely adamant that he would never hold a referendum on membership of the European Community. It was one of the few things he really planted his colours in the ground over. He was the kind of Ian Paisley of the Brexit debate, shouting never across the floor of the House of Commons. But by 1975, he had reached a point where the only way to hold the Labour Party together was to put it to a referendum. Similarly, I don't think David Cameron has any particularly deep attachment to the constitutional principle of a referendum. I think rather he was confronting an issue that threatened to explode his parliamentary majority, and he asked the electorate to defuse it for him. Unfortunately, in his case, they cut the wrong wire. Now, if we think about where British politics is today, both Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn are absolutely adamant that they do not want another referendum on this issue, that they regard it as settled. If that changes, and I'm not convinced it will, but if that changes, it won't be because of constitutional principle. It won't be because of people protesting on people's vote marches, though I respect the fact that people do that. It will be because they reach a point where they have to make a decision and cannot do so without blowing their parties to pieces. And contrary to Jacob Rees-Mogg, I don't see anyone in British politics who's prepared to play the role of Sir Robert Peel, who's actually willing actively to choose to break their party in order to get through the settlement that they want. So those are my first two words, humility and party. My third would be challenge. Britain joined the European Community in the first place in the 1970s at a time when the British state and British politics generally seemed to be under very severe challenges. It was a time of major economic crisis. It was a time when the Soviet Union seemed to be on the march. It was a time when the United States seemed to be riven with its own scandals and internal disagreements and the fallout from a president who had faced impeachment. It was also a time when tariff barriers were going up around the world, when the great powers seemed to be engaging in trade wars with one another. And it was also a time when Britain was trying to establish a role for itself as a medium-sized post-imperial power that wanted to punch above its weight in the world. Now, when I started writing this book, that world felt very, very distant. I have to say, it doesn't feel as distant today. And I think that's important, because the reason why every Prime Minister from Harold Macmillan through to David Cameron backed membership of the European Community was because it seemed to provide an answer to the big fundamental questions of British politics. How could Britain punch above its weight once it had lost its empire? How could it reorient its economy in a post-industrial world? How could it exert some influence on the rules of the economy as a medium-sized economy? And it also, over time, came to be seen as a solution to the Northern Irish question, which again had been at its most destructive in the 1970s. Now, it might well be that joining the European Community was the wrong answer to those questions. That's a perfectly legitimate viewpoint. But by leaving Europe, by rejecting the closest thing Britain's had to a national strategy since the 1970s, all of those questions roar back into life again. And that means that British politics over the next few years faces some really difficult and really serious decisions. And I have to say, I don't really see much evidence in Parliament at the moment on either side of the kind of creative thinking that's going to be needed to answer those. And the scale of those questions, I think, is another reason why, whatever happens in the next few weeks, nothing is going to be settled on the 29th of March of next year. So actually, if I had to pick three words that perhaps personify what Brexit means to me, I'm afraid they would be nowhere near finished. Thank you.
Thank you. Piers.
Thanks a lot. So a second historian's point of view, although I'm going to cover a bit sort of, or you strayed into the present as well. And I'm also going to play this game of having my cake and eat it, if I'm allowed to use that phrase in the Brexit context, and use three words separately, but also a three-word sort of summing up at the end. My three words start with a sort of slightly peculiar one, namely fissile, namely the way in which, and this picks up something that Rob was talking about, the way in which Europe has this extraordinary capacity to break apart British political parties. The phrase comes from a book, This Blessed Plot, by a former Guardian journalist, Hugo Young, who wrote a very sort of good narrative history of the Britain and Europe debate. And he sort of coined the term fissile effect for what he observes happening to the Labour Party in the 1970s, but then the Tories in the 1990s. Now, that book came out, I think, in the early years of this century, but we are now, in a sense, seeing that once more. This extraordinary capacity of this particular issue, for reasons that perhaps we can explore in the discussion, to break apart political parties. Not necessarily definitively. The Labour Party, of course, in the 1970s did split, and you have the launch of the Social Democratic Party partly over the European issue. But nevertheless, parties don't necessarily actually fall apart over the issue, because party sort of the disincentives in the British political system to break parties up are very, very great. But they do find it almost impossible to function, which, as Rob was saying, is one of the reasons why two prime ministers have now resorted to this unusual expedient of a referendum to try and get out of that particular problem. So I think that this is it is, in a sense, sort of not quite, I don't want to make it an iron law of British politics, but it is a recurrent phenomenon that we've seen in the past, we see at the moment, and I suspect we are going to see in the future. And I agree entirely with Rob's final words. We are in no way out of the woods yet, in a sense, irrespective of what happens in the decisive vote in a couple of weeks' time and so on. This is going to be an issue that will continue to divide party and people for a very, very long time. Second of my key words is ignorance, because the single aspect that most depresses me about the whole Brexit story, if you want, is the way in which I get the feeling that neither the British government nor the British people have ever really understood the European system that they joined. I think, as again, I agree with Rob, that there were a series of sort of clear-cut geopolitical and economic reasons why the decision to join in the first place was taken. And one would have thought, after the 1975 referendum in particular, there would have been, in a sense, a sort of wholehearted effort to sort of join properly and to content themselves with membership. But what I find deeply depressing, looking at Britain's 40-year trajectory within the European community, then European Union, is the extraordinary way in which not just the British people at large, but the political elite never really came to terms with what they were joining, continued to talk about it in ways that were deeply inaccurate. And they were either deliberately distorting and taking advantage of the fact that people didn't know better, or in many cases, I think, were genuinely ignorant about the system. And I think this level of ignorance has, in a sense, reached its epitome during the referendum campaign itself, which I found deeply depressing. My wife and I have a system where we tend to sort of get up in the morning listening to the Today programme, but there always comes a point in the morning where we can stand it no longer. We look at each other and say Radio 3, and we turn it over and listen to some classical music instead. During the referendum campaign, it was classical music before we'd even got out of the bedroom. It was just so enormously depressing, the level of the debate. I actually broke one radio because I got so cross, and I threw it to the floor. So it was a very bad debate. But if you in many ways, the negotiations have been equally depressing in terms of their ignorance. This ought to have been a divorce negotiation, if you can use that metaphor of divorce, where both parties knew each other so well that they should have been able to anticipate each other's every move. And yet, in fact, the British debate has, in a sense, been wrong at every single stage about what the EU was likely to do. It was deeply predictable, and yet we seem to be deeply shocked that we've got there. And so, again, it's really in the manner of our leaving that we have most clearly shown how little we understood the system in the first place. So I'm afraid ignorance is my second word. Third word, and again, this is partly a kind of forward-looking thing, so to end on a similar kind of note to Rob, and indeed, in some ways, to make the same point, my third word is geography. Because one of the things that I think gets lost in the current debate is the way in which we are sort of, in a sense, inextricably bound by where we are. Whatever we decide, however we decide to pitch our national strategy, however we decide to organise our trade policy, we are not only 20 miles from the continent, but we are also, because of the Irish situation, actually in between different parts of the EU. We're not quite as surrounded as Switzerland is, but we are almost as surrounded by the EU as the Swiss are. And that means, again, that whatever we decide to do, we are going to be influenced by this entity which is close to us and around us in ways that just have not been anticipated and are going to go on causing difficulties, problems and embarrassments for our political system for the foreseeable future. And so I, too, don't think this is the end of the story. I think this is perhaps approaching the end of a particular chapter, but this particular saga is going to run and run and run, and historians 50 years hence, 100 years hence, are probably going to be talking about it in a way that we can't possibly anticipate. So I'll end there.
Thank you. So we have a non-controversial conclusion that Brexit will be good for academic research. Jennifer.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm going to admit immediately that, of course, being a politics person, we are always, I think, slightly teased for having very short understandings of the past. I'm going to embrace this, and I'm going to talk mostly about the present, but I'm adding nuance, gentlemen, because I think you both cheated by picking three separate words. So I'm coming up with sentences. Hopefully that will take care of the inadequacy of the past. So my very short three-word sentence is a house divided, and I really want to pick up the theme of division and divisiveness, which for me is the most powerful hallmark of Brexit. And first of all, I think just to reflect for a moment on the actual practice of having a referendum, and this is obviously unavoidably to some extent a polarizing effort, isn't it? Because you cannot answer the question, it depends. Right? You must take an either yes or a no. You are remain or you are leave. And so the very sense in which this whole debate is put in this incredibly simplified and polarized way, I think, is part of what has produced the outcome, which, of course, as we know, obviously very divisive, very narrow in its result, 48-52. But equally, if we look across such a broad range of possible indicators of coming together or moving apart, the moving apart seems to dominate. So we have the moving apart in terms of regions, the kind of landscape itself becoming increasingly segmented. We have, of course, Scotland and Northern Ireland voting to remain, Wales voting to leave, parts of England, the north of England, voting to leave, London and pockets in the southeast and particular areas where universities are, of course, voting very strongly to remain. So that fractured sense of geography as part of the divisiveness. As a student of nationalism, and I know Tony may want to pick this up, you know, we spend a lot of time when we study nationalism and ethnic conflict looking for ways of creating what's referred to as cross-cutting cleavages, things that will bring populations together. And political parties are usually a big point of interest. And here again, isn't it quite remarkable that neither political party seems to be bringing together leave and remain? In fact, they're just as fractured inside of one another, you know, as they were when we went in. I think they're probably just as much so at this point in time. And then finally, for me, the most salient, because this has become a core part of my own research efforts in the period since Brexit and the referendum, is the question of the age divide. The sense in which you did have this striking phenomenon in which beneath 50 age demographic, there is a majority in favor of remain, and over 50, there is a majority in favor of leave, and every decade that you move from 49 towards the youngest voters at 18, the proportion voting remain increases until we get to our youngest cohort, which was the strongest group to endorse remain, and I think something like 74, 75. Latest polls put it now, I think, at 80, so that's strengthened rather than attenuated. And if you move in the opposite direction, you have a similar effect. So the further you go away from 50, the greater the percentage in favor of leave, except, interestingly, for the oldest voters who actually did vote remain, probably, historians win this one, because they remembered the Second World War. So all of that pattern of divide, I think, stands out. And it really feeds into the idea behind the Generation Brexit Project, which I was also asked to speak about. This is an online initiative to try and crowdsource a pan-European, multilingual vision for the future relationship after Brexit. Of course, a future relationship has inevitably to encompass two, at least, perspectives on things, to bridge a divide, because that's the essence of a common relationship. And so we were interested in finding out what that would be. And as part of this, we have written a recent report for the All-Party Parliamentary Group on a Better Brexit for Young People. And what did we find? Well, again, we found, on the one hand, an awful lot of commonality amongst young people, reflected, of course, on the way that they voted. They do have a lot in common. But equally, we found real evidence of continued division as well. We asked in a public opinion survey put out by Opinium, more than 1,000 young people aged 18 to 35, who do you talk to Brexit about? And what we found is that people will only talk to Brexit or about Brexit with those that they anticipate already share their point of view. Equally, they are most hesitant to have these conversations with older relatives, grandparents singled out, because they feel that they will be a difference and also because they feel they will be patronized in terms of their own views. So that really seemed to underscore yet another permutation of the divisiveness that has been created, in a sense, where we should be having a joined up national debate. We are in fact collapsing into two solitudes, leave and remain, still really not speaking to one another. And even when we spoke to young people in our focus groups and online on the platform, if you're interested, you'll see this as well, about the question of what happens Parliament can't decide, do we need a people's vote? And interestingly, the young people that we spoke to and in the survey, are still divided on this point. Young people themselves taking very different views. Half of them saying, absolutely, we need another vote because of all of the inadequacies of the old one, and out of a concern that all views are heard, particularly now that we can really see the choice being made. But on the other side, half saying, well, no, because if we do this again, it's going to divide us even further, and that is going to make things even more difficult going forward. And the final point, which I think for me was the most striking of all, what we hear over and over again on the platform and also through the survey is the view that the whole Brexit process has been experienced fundamentally as divisive. So this is how it's becoming as a kind of lived reality. And equally, that young people do not like the kind of divisive politics that have emerged very fundamentally as a result of it. So aggressive politics between political elites in a very polarized way. They wish it would stop, and they worry quite deeply that it's going to be an obstacle in terms of producing a beneficial, positive relationship between the UK and the EU after Brexit, but equally, it's going to get in the way of creating a positive politics inside the UK after Brexit, and in fact, the fear is there's going to be further fragmentation, you know, between the regions, across age cohorts, across other sort of preferences in terms of voting and so on. So my last three words, again, to paraphrase the historians, David Cameron, when he announced this exercise, said that he hoped it would settle the Europe question for a generation. And I think, in fact, in my mind, this is my last three words, it is unsettled a generation. And obviously the generation, it has unsettled, particularly our young people.
Thank you very much. Tony.
Okay, well, my three words, are executive, legislature, and people. I think what we're involved here is a complex struggle, which is in much the same way that I thought at the time the 2008 banking crisis, all that fell out of that, gave us all a short, sharp lesson in economics. We're now getting a short, sharp lesson of history tonight, but also the way government and political institutions work. So, as I think, you know, historians sitting along here, so I'll be careful. I mean, I think Europe has been a long-term challenge for UK politicians, partly because of the country's history. It's an island, it hasn't been invaded as recently as many other places. And it had this global self-image, you know, the empire, then the Commonwealth, and that somehow distant places that used to be coloured pink on the map were sort of more important than this place nearby, which was troublesome and we fought wars with for centuries and all that. And I'm rather deep into history, so I know I'm going slightly into dangerous territory here. And of course it meant that after 1945, Labour and Conservative politicians were pretty unenthusiastic about the idea of what emerged as the coal and steel community and then the EEC. And some politicians, de Gaulle particularly in France, probably understood this better than anybody. That in a sense, the British were always going to be a bit difficult. And I've been fascinated myself with the counterfactual thought of what Britain would be like, what its relationship with the EU would be today, if the United Kingdom had never joined. Think that through. It would be, I suspect, halfway between Switzerland and Norway, and some sort of halfway in, halfway out, some right, some, and all of that. Anyway, we'll talk about that perhaps later. So, and of course, many of the problems that, in a sense, inform the way the Conservative and Labour parties in particular thought about this in the 40s and 50s, tell you something about those parties then and even today, that the Conservative Party is a mixture of sort of empire loyalists with a bit of nationalism thrown in, tangled up with global free traders, all visible in the debate that's going on about Brexit and the type of Brexit. The Labour Party was a mixture of sort of middle class internationalists who, you know, wanted to understand the world, and protectionists who wanted to protect British workers from global trade, as it's now called, trade as it used to be seen. And again, Britain had set all the terms of international trade for a century or centuries, I'm just looking at my historian colleagues here, some time. suddenly finding itself having to compete. So all of that history, which in some way informs the makeup of the British political parties, sort of still underpins this debate, which has been fought out over the issue of whether the United Kingdom should, well, it's voted to, or should not leave the European Union. And of course, this, all of these issues overlay, and Jennifer mentioned this, the sort of traditional left-right orientation of the Labour and Conservative parties in Britain. Not all countries have left-right orientations for their major parties. We have to have a plurality, first-past-the-post voting system, two strong parties. I'll come back to that in a moment. But of course, for the moment, all of that is nonsense. You've not only got these long-term attributes of the major political parties, but and Brexit, traditional left-right orientation in politics, but now overlaid with personalities. So a struggle within the Conservative Party, at least, for its future. Not only the Conservative Party. Most Labour MPs don't want Jeremy Corbyn as leader of the Labour Party. Most Conservative MPs will probably get rid of Mrs May as leader of the Conservative Party in a system that requires each leader to have a majority supporting them in the House of Commons. Not easy to sort that out. So I think the Cabinet's now handed the whole problem on to Parliament. It says, the government decided to hold a referendum, the people decided to give the executive something to do, and they've now got as far as they can, and they're handing this back, or handing it on now, to the legislature. And this will end up with a meaningful vote, well, probably not very meaningful the way things are going, but still. And I'm just playing around with music. There's a marvellous sort of series of what might happen if, and I won't go through it all, but clearly the meaningful vote can either lead to Mrs. May getting what she wants or not, which might lead to a vote of confidence if she doesn't, which might or might not lead to a general election or indeed a challenge to her, which could lead to a Conservative leadership challenge. Or, the thing I find most interesting myself, it might lead to some way of amending on a second attempt what she's put forward, which could lead to, well, if you want one thing, a second vote, or Norway plus plus, or something else besides. All of these things are up in the air at the moment as we speak. So, what does this mean for the future of British politics? Well, I think it means that both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, it's just fascinating to dwell on the fact that the Prime Minister, the leader of the Conservative Party, voted Remain, and she's pushing through Brexit. And the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, certainly voted Leave in 1975 and is now leading the party, which sort of inherits the mantle of being slightly less anti, slightly less pro-Brexit. And therefore, you've got one party which is sort of slightly pro-Brexit and the other which is slightly against it. So you can, as a voter, allow yourself to choose between these two, even though both parties are split and signalling a whole range of views within themselves. So, the implications for British politics looking ahead. I think it could change the orientation of these parties. It could be that the Conservative Party becomes the party of a sort of more closed, protectionist, different kind of worldview than many Conservatives have traditionally held. It might not end like that, but it could. There are certainly people who would certainly tilt it in that direction. And Labour could be the party of sort of Europe, but nevertheless with protectionist elements inside it as well. So it's not going to end easily or quickly. It's a bit of a muddle, really. So my just coming back to the three words I chose, executive, legislature, and people, we're involved in these three elements. Thank goodness the courts are no longer, they were briefly involved, but they're not really going to help. Three separate groups are, I think, now between them trying to resolve what is the biggest single challenge to the British political system since 1945. And in its resolution will be, either we do leave the EU in a certain way, or it could be no deal way, could be Mrs May's way, could be some other MP's way, could be a vote to remain. Views on that. Thank you very much.
Well, excellent. I think we've covered quite a range of different aspects here. As I said at the beginning, we're here to reflect on the library exhibition of what Brexit means to you. So can I, without asking my colleagues to come back with further comments or me asking them questions at the moment, can I immediately open it up to you and invite you to say what Brexit means to you? I will even allow you more than three words. Who wants to start us off, please? Any comments on what Brexit means to you? Please. Yeah, there's a microphone because everything is being recorded. Could you just say who you are and...
Yes, my name is Giulio and I'm a master's student in international political economy. It was said... I'm sorry, they couldn't catch...
Tony Travers.
Yes.
You must be one of the few people at the LSE not to know the name.
Sorry. my bad. It's an ignorance. It's just arrived.
Sorry.
No. You said something interesting, in, which I'm like, in a way, to challenge. You said just as the 2008 crisis taught us something about economics, this crisis has taught us something about the way politics work. And I would like to challenge that in the sense that I believe that we didn't learn much from the 2008 financial crisis and we're not learning much from this. And I refer in particular to what you, the EU is, could have learned and is in fact not doing. Two words have been said that for me are particularly interesting, humility by Dr. Saunders and the concept of divisiveness. What I am missing, or what I was hoping the day after the referendum vote, was, okay, Europe, learn the lesson and start thinking about how, why this happened and how to avoid it in the future. And what I find striking and particularly disappointing and dangerous is the fact that now the EU and politicians all over Europe are pointing to Britain as the bad children and say, look what happens. And the problem with this is I'm also seeing a lot of victimization, but a lot of regret inside the British society. And to a certain extent, this is right, but at the same time, there are deep flaws in Europe that are not being addressed in any way. And actually, this is reinforcing these mechanisms. And for me, this is a lost opportunity, just like the 2008 crisis was a lost opportunity. Thank you.
Many thanks. Others, please. Other comments, contributions. At the back.
Hello. So I'm a master's student on the public administration program at university. So I'm from Norway. And for us, Brexit has been an interesting kind of, it's also put Norway into a pedestal in trying to define what our privileges is within the EU or how we could define our own position versus what would happen eventually maybe with Britain. But also from my perspective, I also think it's kind of indicative of a larger trend within the world in that it is also kind of, appealing to the sentiments of the elderly parts of the population through migration and this kind of xenophobic sentiments and populism in general. So that is maybe how Brexit kind of appeals to me. Yeah.
Okay, great. Others, please. We'll come to you as well.
Theo, I'm an MPA alum, and I now work at the FCA. And I was unfortunate enough to be one of those who had to read the 595 pages of the entire deal that day was signed, and it's long. My understanding, and I'm French, by the way, so I'm biased, but my understanding of the Brexit as it stood was that, and I completely join the point here, is that the campaign was absolutely awful, and the ground on which the vote was based were actually extremely flawed and were just a missed occasion to truly talk about what Europe was, was not, and what the true role of the UK was in the EU. What's striking now is that the democratic choice, which is an extremely pure way to exercise democracy through a referendum, whether we like it or not, The moment it's chosen, it is an extremely pure way to express democracy. This has been, for the past 2 years, completely... The way it's been dealt with by administrations, both in the UK and the EU, has been, from my own perspective, a little shameful. The people have spoken, we're not too sure of what, if only that we needed to leave the EU. What's come out of the agreement that I've had the great chance to read is that actually this principal agent authority that the EU would be deciding over the lives of UK citizens, which is one of the reasons why UK citizens voted against the EU, is not only reinforced but now without voting powers. And we're telling the UK citizens that actually they've regained control of their borders, which is yet to be determined. And you have this clause in the withdrawal agreement that says the transition period will end in 2000, and then instead of numbers, you have XX, which is essentially 2000 and infinity. Where does the democracy lie there? Are we respecting a democratic decision? I don't personally believe that's the case. And in that sense, if only purely for democratic means, should we not go for a no-deal Brexit? And that's a question I'm not allowed to say yes, but I strongly ask myself.
Okay, good. And then a friend over here, Bob.
Hello, my name is Bob. I'm not European, I'm Chinese. But I do take the course on Brexit that's offered by LSE. And I think the event really made me reflect how I should view democracy. Because I think previously, having come from China, I thought democracy is something we didn't have, and it may be something good. But I think from this discussion, you know, many people, there was ignorance being mentioned in this very monumental decision being made that is based on mass ignorance. It just made me think maybe democracy is not necessarily, at least as reflected by this very divisive referendum, it's just not necessarily the best thing to make a decision. And I think Brexit has somewhat cast doubt on, I think not only me, but many of my also Chinese friends view what is the best way to govern a country or make a decision politically.
Many thanks. Others? Please.
Thank you. So my name is Robert, and I'm currently visiting the European Institute. And I'm also Danish, and we've had our fair share of referendums, and we joined the EU basically because the UK did, and our biggest agricultural market was suddenly inside some tax walls. What has surprised me tremendously when watching this process is, and this is not to be rude, but it seems like all adults have left the room whenever you were to make this Brexit deal. And I simply do not understand, or from a Scandinavian, I guess my Norwegian friend would probably say the same thing, from a Scandinavian point of view, we would expect our elites to at least take care of the country and set aside ideological divides. After our 1993 referendums, people got shot in the streets of Copenhagen, right? The police shot at people. But nevertheless, elites got together and fixed a deal and fixed four opt-outs that everybody supported, from the far right to the far, far, far Marxist left. Everybody stood behind the prime minister, who was on a difficult task. Why don't we see that in Britain? And will we see that in Britain sometime in the future?
Many thanks. Others? Thomas here, front.
Thank you for a very interesting discussion. Just to put a bit more of a positive spin on all of this, it's been thoroughly depressing. I was thinking of the word opportunity for both the United Kingdom and the European Union. So I was wondering if, in terms of the United Kingdom, if the panel thought that there is an opportunity in terms of continuing to cooperate and trade and work closely with the European Union, to also engage with other countries that are experiencing, you know, exciting levels of economic growth. And on the other side, in terms of the European Union, whether this is finally a chance to get rid of a very difficult, obstructive, awkward member state that has prevented other member states from pursuing deeper political integration. We're already seeing Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel voicing support for European army, for example, which the United Kingdom has always opposed. So I was wondering if actually Brexit also provides an opportunity for the EU to get to further integration. Thank you.
Very good. Other comments, other contributions? I'll come back to give you the opportunity. Can I invite Robert to respond to Robert? And also, the point I want to make is that quite rightly, you emphasize that the Europe issue has been divisive between parties. Parties haven't been able to contain the issue. But then also, when listening to you, I was thinking, over time, we've never had a majority in Parliament which we could describe as Eurosceptic. Moreover, if we think in terms of elections, we haven't had a national parliamentary election where Europe, we hadn't had a parliamentary election until 2015 at which Europe was one of the top three issues in terms of public opinion. So you made the very good point that we finally joined because Europe seemed to be answering the big strategic questions for the UK. Moreover, as you say, that it was divisive within parties. Nevertheless, in terms of Robert's point about elites, we had something of a broad elite consensus. We've never had a Eurosceptic majority in Parliament. So how did we get into that situation, do you think?
Yeah. When you were speaking, Robert, I was thinking that I think one of the fundamental problems, certainly for the last 2 years, has been that both parties have approached Brexit as a problem of party management rather than as a problem of statecraft, and that the fundamental objective has been to hold the party together. And I think that's almost always been true of the way that British parties have engaged with this question. And their tendency, the way that they've preferred to deal with the question, certainly the pro-Europeans in the party, has been to anaesthetise it, to push it to one side. And I think that's one of the things that builds up to the explosion in 2016. That on the morning after the vote, I was speaking at a press conference, and to the gentleman, I think to Thomas, who talked about an opportunity, I said actually on that day that while I was a Remainer, I did think that there was something wonderful about the idea that the electorate could overturn 40 years of established state policy with a vote, and that if you were looking for an upside, that was probably it. And that Brexit partly came out of a failure of Britain's democratic institutions to represent what people actually thought. And I think when you look at 2015, the election there, and you see that 4 million people voted UKIP, and they got one MP who was a Tory plant anyway, who wasn't really UKIP, our democratic institutions were not doing their job of representing an important strain of opinion. And actually, had they done so, it's possible that we might not have ended up where we did. Because I think, you know, actually, there is a case to be made that giving people democratic responsibility forces their arguments into the open, forces them to be tested and debated, and can actually be, if you regard Brexit as a problem, then democracy might contain within it some of the seeds of the cure. So I don't think, I agree that we shouldn't talk about the referendum simply as if it's some kind of tragedy. But I do think that we need, if we're going to have referendums as part of our constitution, and it looks like we are now, we need to think seriously about how we use them and when and what sort of procedures we follow. And I think the recent Irish referendum on abortion was a really interesting counterexample, where you had, I think, a kind of people's assembly that came up with a clear proposal, and then you had a vote knowing what the result of that, knowing what the outcome of a yes or no was going to be. It was a very specific proposition. The problem, I think, was that what we put to the electorate in 2016 was an abstract principle. Would you like to leave the EU? And as I think Theo said, we've kind of been spending the last 2 years trying to work out what this meant. And every concrete form of Brexit that's put forward loses or alienates some of those who voted for Brexit in the referendum. So, you know, I think by all means make direct democracy a part of our constitutional arrangements, but think about how we do it and try to make sure that we don't end up in a situation where we're just voting on abstract principles, which then have a religious authority because the people have willed them, but that we can't agree on how to turn into material action.
Piers, do you want to respond on this theme perhaps of opportunity, on Robert's point that Europe was previously an answer to the big strategic questions? And I noticed when coming in to the library on the exhibition screen, one of the large electronic screens, someone had defined Brexit in 3 words of less global influence. And I wonder, connecting with what Robert had said, how you respond to the narrative, as it were, of what is the UK's future role?
Okay, a lot of good comments and good questions. Just on the opportunity point, the problem is I don't really see very many opportunities opening up that, in a sense, weren't already there when it comes to engagement with the outside world. Sort of, there was a debate about how outward-looking or otherwise the EU should be, and there were certain aspects of the EU, notably the Common Agricultural Policy, which was highly protectionist and therefore was an impediment to dealing with the rest of the world. But if you look at a number of countries inside the EU, whether the Scandinavian countries or the Germans or whatever, they trade much more with many of the emerging markets than the British do. And the idea that actually changing our status vis-a-vis, the idea that it was the EU what was holding us back, or that the solution is getting rid of the EU, really doesn't square for me at all. So I think there is a big debate to be had about, in a sense, how Britain engages with the outside world. But I don't really see that the argument that there was a kind of safety belt holding us back in the form of the EU holds much water. On this position of influence, this is for me one of the key aspects of the ignorance that I was talking about in my brief intervention before. One of the mysteries for me about British membership, and I'm sort of, Rob was flagging his book that he's produced. I perhaps should refer to one which I want to produce, because the next book I want to write is going to be a 40-year sort of study of Britain's 40 whatever it is years in the EU. And one of the central mysteries of that book will be how the British convinced themselves they had so little influence when actually they had so much. Because if you go round Brussels, particularly if you talk to the French late at night after a couple, they've had a cup of cognac, etc., they will tell you that Brussels is run by les Anglo-Saxons and various ideas are attributed to... Now, that is an oversimplification. It's not just the British, it's partly about the particular trends of intellectual economic thought and so on. So there were other factors as well, but the British actually played the Brussels game quite well. And you can identify at multiple levels a huge number of both policy areas and British individuals who've had a real impact. And yet, that story of British influence has virtually no resonance in the British domestic debate about Europe, which was nearly always about what they were doing to us, or sometimes what they were preventing us, to go back to the opportunity thing, from doing. So it was all about sort of them out there forcing us here to do things or to not do things. And the two just don't square. And it's very difficult, and I certainly don't have the answers. I have a few sort of vestigial explanations, but I really don't understand how that disjuncture came about, how, in a sense, we could both have so much influence and persuade ourselves we had so little. And that is going to be one of the key mysteries with which I'm going to have to tangle in this book.
Many thanks. Jennifer, I wonder if you'd like to respond to the various points, perhaps particularly, why didn't we learn more?
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful question. There's so many learning opportunities in life. I'm sure this is one. Then again, obviously, there's a huge number of issues one could point to. We've actually asked many of the young people that we've spoken to, what do they think the lessons are? So I think I'm going to cheat and just invoke their wisdom. when we speak to those from the EU, we get a clearer signal back that what we should learn is, first of all, to teach the populace, particularly young people in schools, what the EU does, so people are actually clear about it, because there's a perception that there's an awful lot of confusion. Equally, there's a perception that there needs to be, and this is shared with young people in the UK, much more education on civics per se. So how do governments work? How do electoral systems work? And even beyond that, how to have difficult conversations about questions that people really feel passionate about. So how do we actually engage? I think this is particularly important for those young people who tell us they have an interest, but they don't talk about it because they don't feel confident about talking about it. So that sense of empowerment through education, I think, is an enormous lesson. The other points that get said over and over again have to do with the media, and particularly with social media. We need to do something about social media regulation. We have to come to grips with that. We need to be able to teach young people in schools how to identify the difference between real news and fake news so that people become better consumers of information out there, and hopefully they will be empowered, therefore, to make kind of better and more constructive choices. So I think certainly all of those are lessons. And I was struck by the question around opportunity. I think I would phrase that even more boldly. I think we've reached the point where it is a necessity. Things must change because, quite frankly, it cannot go on the way it is. And it's torturous. It's torturous if you're passionately interested. It's torturous if you're totally disinterested. You know, something has got to happen. We've got to somehow move forward. Move forward, obviously, with the EU, but equally move forward inside the country to get beyond all of these divisions. And again, some of the key lessons we get back are increasing attention to what does it mean to be British? What are the rights of British citizens? What are the rights of residents in the United Kingdom? What are the values that unites us? And why can't we have more of a conversation about the things that matter to all of us? Maybe it's the NHS, which is something that all generations and everywhere seems to really value and want to have greater prioritization. So I think moving on in some way towards these other issues that have been completely sidetracked has got to happen and soon.
Thank you. Tony, what on earth has happened to British democracy? The phrase shameful was used. Robert has just suggested that we might actually have the fun of future referenda as well.
Yes, I mean, just to address the initial question that was aimed, I'll come to that one, aimed to me about the learning experience. Mm. I mean, it was slightly, I should have expressed it more clearly. It wasn't that I thought the political class had learned, but that we learned from it, in the sense that, you know, traffic engineers learn from very bad traffic congestion about traffic. So it's more that, you know, we do, I think we are seeing a great deal now about the way in which the British political system works, which will lead me to answer the second question, for good or for ill. And I think one of the things you can say as to whether, in a sense, there's mass ignorance here, and is this a challenge for democracy? Well, in fairness to Mrs. May, I think she has been trying to find a democratic way out which squares the very many circles that are here. And, you know, you can like her or dislike her, but I think what she's actually trying to do is that, to find a way that doesn't. I mean, the Chequers proposals were really an attempt to protect manufacturing industry and agriculture, largely where the industries which happen to be big in areas that where people voted for Leave, from an immediate and sudden change to the UK economy, which is what no deal would lead to. Now, I think so. I think, in a sense, you can see how first she and now Parliament is trying to come to terms with the message sent. And the message sent, Robert made this point, the message sent by the referendum, whether you like it or not, was a message that somebody needed to understand. The political elite hadn't clocked it. They didn't understand it. And whatever you personally think about, you know, whether it was a good idea or a bad idea, it will force people in politics, in academic life, elsewhere, to think hard about what the message was about. Because in fairness, you know, I think some people voted, Kevin's heard me say this before, some people undoubtedly voted to leave the EU, but others were voting on a whole range of other issues, and the risk to the government now is, actually, that they don't address the other issues. They might leave the EU, but frankly, that will not make people on, you know, who have poorly paid jobs in parts of the country where the economy works, won't make them any better off, and that's the real threat. Fewer migrants will just mean public services don't run as well as they do. It won't, I'm afraid, address all the problems that migration itself is a proxy for, which leads me to my final point, which is the adults in the room problem. And of course, the difficulty with all of this is that the Brexit vote, the referendum and its outcomes have triggered something the British used broadly to avoid, which was a full throttle, visible from space culture war.
Mm.
Okay. Just look at the Twitter, I'm not on Twitter, look at the Twitter feeds of people who strongly believe one thing or the other. They are absolutely and totally unwilling to give ground to each other. It's a sort of painful, cruel, I'll lose my friend, or I want people who don't agree with me kind of struggle. And of course, that does point to a real choice, which we've touched on already this evening. There are people who believe strongly in Brexit who want to change the economy and the country. So, you know, as Vernon Bognor said elsewhere, another event here, it's what they want is Mrs. Thatcher's fourth government. That's what they want, to check the final things that Mrs. Thatcher's government couldn't deliver. A radically deregulated British economy, cut off from all the constraints of that hold it back, trading with the world, all that kind of Singapore on Thames sort of stuff. Wonderful place, Singapore. Whether it's as good on Thames is another matter. On one side, and on the other side, and I think this is made closer to this position, as are many Labour politicians actually, which is trying to make it as near to no change as possible. Because most politicians don't like radical insurrectionist change, but some do. They want to bring it about. There are some people on the pro-Brexit side who want to do that, some people in the leadership of the Labour Party who want to do that. Interestingly, they're on the same side on this.
Thank you very much indeed. I see now that actually we're almost out of time. Are there any last comments or questions, or any comments that the panelists want to come back on? Thomas? If you just wait for the microphone, thank you.
Thank you. Just in terms of the future aspect, if we can get involved, maybe this is more for Tony Travers, in terms of the parliamentary arithmetic. So at the moment, it seems unlikely that Mrs. May's deal won't pass through Parliament. Is there much truth in the idea that if she then, passes some sort of amendments to the bill that don't actually mean that much, but will provide an opportunity for it to, go to the House a second time, perhaps to sort of panic the markets and so on, and MPs will realise that a no-deal scenario is a very real prospect. Do you think the bill could then pass on a second attempt?
Tony.
First, I wouldn't trust my political predictions before we go any further. More seriously, there's a brilliant House of Commons library note on the meaningful vote, which I strongly recommend to those of you who are interested in this stuff, and certainly lawyers, to read. It's great. It's very, very helpful. All the evidence suggests that it's going to be very hard to get her proposals through on the first vote. But you can hear some MPs saying, you can see in the way that politicians work, some of the hardcore Remainers will vote for it because they think she's going to lose it, if you see what I mean. So they're going to vote for the government knowing that the Brexit people will defeat it. So they win twice out of that. That's how politicians think. And then there will be, if she loses on the first, that Labour will put down a vote of no confidence, almost certainly, and she would then win the vote of confidence. The Conservatives would win that. Mrs. May is a resilient person. She's not going to give up at this stage, I guess. Then the question is, does she go back to Brussels and say, well, if you give me a little bit of this and that, we're nearly at the 29th of March, there's the cliff edge, then brings that back. That would produce some kind of majority in the Commons for her deal plus, minus, plus, wherever it turned out to be. or would a group of MPs manage to amend through some procedural device in the House of Commons what Mrs. May's trying to do with, you know, something like Nick Bowles' proposal for Norway plus minus squared, you know, whatever that is, you know. Temporarily, obviously, it will be different in the future. Now, that all comes down to the way the House of Commons authorities and the Speaker, what amendments they allow, how the procedure allows this to happen. So, it could be any, as I said earlier, there's quite a wide range of choice here, but my personal instinct is boils down to most members of Parliament, moderate members of Parliament, Labour and Conservative, will not vote for a new deal. I just don't think they'll allow that to happen. So then you're in all the space between that, not being no deal, and a second referendum, which includes a general election on the way. Lots of options.
Thanks. I'm going to
in my predictive capacities, you can now bet on a no deal.
Well, despite that, Tony, I think I'm going to be a really cruel chair and ask you to give me a figure, a probability percentage of Mrs. May being Prime Minister and having secured her Brexit deal by January.
Oh, I think she'll a Brexit deal,
I'll allow you that.
Some kind of deal,
yep,
which the House of Commons has assented to.
Yes.
Which might, of course, nobody even mentioned the possibility of, they were hoping to trigger an extension of Article 50, which of course relies on the EU, a lot of this relies on the, requires the EU to do things as well. So,
give us a figure, go on.
I think she'll, I think, given her resilience so far, I think she's a dead cert for January myself.
To be Prime Minister and to have had a deal on Brexit passed through Parliament.
Yes. By the 31st of January.
By the 31st
some
of January.
Some form of deal will have been passed and she'll be still Prime Minister.
We heard dead cert. Is anyone else wishing to object to or qualify that, Robin?
Can I just respond to something that Tony said just now? You said, I think, that Mrs. May has been trying to respect democracy in the way that she's pursued Brexit. And I think I would partly disagree with that, actually. In that I think that, in general, actually, quite a lot of the political class has taken the view that democracy ended on the 24th of June 2016, that the people spoke, and then democracy has to be put back in its box. And I think Theresa May, you know, went to the Supreme Court rather than let Parliament vote on Article 50, fought the idea of a meaningful vote in Parliament, is adamant there won't be a second referendum, has had to have documents sort of dragged through all sorts of arcane political procedures. And I think that's not just true of her, actually. I think, in a way, Corbyn, similarly, is very opposed to another referendum, has worked very hard to keep the European question off the Labour Party conference, that the internal democracy of the Labour Party is not being invited to the feast here. And I actually take the view that if we are going to do what Jennifer talked about and try to find a form of reconciliation, a way of rebuilding our civil society, the only way you can respond to a democratic crisis is by more democracy. If we believe in democracy, then we believe that the way in which you stabilise a country, where you get a good outcome, is by talking and discussion and by continuing the processes of democracy. And I think the question really is how we do that. And this is a very unfashionable view now, but my view would be that we need a form of democracy that starts from the assumption that we disagree with one another, that provides a platform for people of different opinions to talk to one another, that treats the people as a collection of different units rather than as a singular entity that has a will, and that is Parliament. And I think actually after our various experiments with presidentialised leaderships, with direct democracy, what we really need to do is try to rebuild and reanimate our parliamentary democracy.
I mean, I was going to say almost the same thing, actually, because I do think that the, you know, representative democracy is the thing we broadly know best. We occasionally use referendums, but only occasionally. It kind of works so-so. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's both the EU occasions, it's been used by a party leader to try to solve a party problem. And there's no question that's sort of what I meant about Mrs. May. That I take your point, but she has been, attempting to just about, because it was, I always thought the referendum was a bit like a general election between a party that had a manifesto and one that just had one thing in the manifesto. Mm. And she's been trying to interpret what the one line was in the manifesto in a representative democracy kind of way, squaring off all the interests. And that's why perhaps I'm being a bit overkind to her, but if she hadn't done it, somebody else would have had to try to do it. But I take your point about representative democracy completely.
Well, I just wonder in a sentence if that connects to Robert's point. But actually, I think Theresa May and Corbyn's response has both been that the adults in the room must sort this out privately, behind closed doors.
But if I can jump in just quickly, one of the curiosities of people have spotted it in the news, you know, this whole go to Norway and it's this elegant solution because we can leave and remain at the same time. But a curiosity really struck me recently. It's been reported that both Gove and Rudd are in favor of this, and I thought that's quite interesting. So is the cabinet somehow going to come out and be the only adults over Mrs. May's defeat and work something out, or is this just all kind of conjecture in the media? I don't know. I don't know if anybody else has any better sense of it.
Well, one final thought. I mean, but I think you can be in favor of Mrs. May's deal. I mean, if you think Mrs. May's going to lose the vote on the, if you think Mrs. May's going to lose the vote on the deal, then you can vote for it, knowing it'll be defeated. Do you see what I mean? And so there's a kind of, the way in which politicians think, they may then think their hands will be clean, they can then come back with something different, having voted for her, and she lost. That's the kind of anyway.
It sounds absolutely wonderful, the principles of British democracy. No, I can't imagine why anyone used the word shameful in relation to politicians voting for reasons other than what is actually on the table. Piers, would you like to add any final comment?
Just sort of two very, very quick remarks. I tend to share the kind of idealistic hope that we could return to parliamentary to a more parliamentary democracy. Having said that, at the moment what we're doing seems to be the absolute opposite. I learned this morning from the Today programme that one regular, perhaps it was the lunchtime programme, that one regular German newspaper now has a column on the Houses of Parliament which is called Mad House on the Thames. If that's where we've got to, we've clearly got a problem.
Okay, you didn't expect to come to this as a kind of group therapy session with all of your angst resolved, but at least we are better informed as to why it's complex, uncertain, and bloody difficult. Thank you to our panel.